Yes. I couldn't remember. Yes, let's start. Okay. Welcome back, everybody. It's a new year for you. We're in the old year still, but Adele Buck is finally back on Let's Go Steal a Podcast to start us out for season 4. I cannot believe this is season 4. Either. And honestly, looking through the list of episode titles, I think this might be my favorite season.
It's a really good season.
And I was just I love that one.
I just say how delightful it is to be back because I, as I was saying to you before we started, I missed Leverage. I have missed talking to you about Leverage, but I did not want to pay megabucks for Leverage. So I have not had it for a long time and a lot. I'm very rusty on some of the backstory. So you might have to sort of like wheel me through a few things like the old lady that I am. and speaking of old lady, okay. But because I was the first guest.
Where?
On the first 3 or 4 episodes?
Yeah, it was like you and me for the first, the first season.
110 powers.
Yes.
So thank you. I'm so thrilled to be back. Now, the other point about me being an old lady. I was a teenager in the 80s. Okay. So the reason when you sent out the spreadsheet that had all the things listed, and I was like, I saw this season, and I can be kind of hazy about titles. Like, was that the one? I mean, they're pretty good about like matching the titles to what actually happened. So it's easier for me, but I can get really kind of about not remembering what goes to what. But I saw this one. I was like, that, I think that's the mountaineering episode with Eric Stoltz. Hell yeah. For those of us who appreciated Ginger,
oh my gosh,
we who came of age in the 80s have been appreciating Mr. Stoltz for quite some time.
Yeah,
so
I came of age a little later, but definitely grew up on 80s teen films, and Some Kind of Wonderful is my favorite John Hughes film. It is my favorite.
Yeah, I think it's probably the one I've seen the least, and yet it's probably also my favorite.
It's great.
Hard to go back to some of those. I mean,
yes, there are many, Kibbles, many problematic things.
Yeah, 16 Candles is so incredibly racist, and Pretty in Pink is really boring now. It's very slow.
Yeah. 16 Candles is also like really bad about consent.
Oh, really rapey. Oh yeah. No, I can remember being a little, even, you know, having grown up in that era and watching it in like when it came out in the movie theaters and all that kind of stuff. I remember going like, do not just pass around a girl like she's candy. No, that's gross.
No.
Yeah. Anyway,
sorry. I'm here for Jake Ryan. It's not all right.
John Hughes tangent over. Yeah.
We can come back to it. Eric Stoltz wasn't even officially credited in this episode.
He did it as a favor to them. Okay. I've also done some of my usual Kung Fu Monkey research.
Good. We'll preface the whole episode. So this one aired on June 26th, 2011. It was written by Joe Hortua. I think I'm saying that right. And John Rogers. And it was directed by Dean Devlin. To look into the death of a mountaineer at the hands of a corrupt financial executive, the team reunites to take on a mountain. Okay, what did you find?
So, first of all, Joe Hortua, if that's how we're pronouncing it, I have no idea. He was apparently, at the time, one of their new executive story editors, and he was a climber.
Yes.
And so, apparently, this is delightful. I walked into Dean's office and said, "How'd you like to shoot the premiere on Mount Hood?" To which he replied, "Will it be unreasonably dangerous and possibly kill us?" No, he did not say that, but he might as well.
I love it. I love that they actually filmed this on a real live mountain and not a soundstage with like a green screen.
Yeah, and they apparently filmed at about 8,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because I got the questions that he goes through are really interesting. Like somebody actually was like, no, this is you're below the tree line, couldn't possibly been that high, bullshit. And he's like, actually, no, here's where we were, choke on it.
Yeah, and they were initially worried that there wasn't going to be enough snow and they'd have to put some fake snow out, but then a blizzard came in and they were like, oh, it's fine.
Yay.
So, like, all that weather is real. They did film some parts on a set, but it was inside the hotel from The Shining?
Well, they also filmed that cave was a set.
Okay. Well, good. I'm glad they didn't drop them into an actual crevasse. This match. No,
but apparently they used stunties for that with Christian Kane standing off to the side, basically going, it's only 14 feet.
Could have done it.
Exactly.
So grumpy about not doing stunts.
So grumpy in wonderful ways. I love his grump. But yeah, so apparently Dean Devlin and Eric Stoltz go way back, and they knew they needed, I mean, he's literally in, you know, they chop it up in editing, but he's got basically two scenes.
Yeah.
And then he apparently played a corpse.
Well, so they didn't have to, when he's the corpse.
Yeah, they didn't have to make a dummy.
Which is good, because those never look right.
No. They never look right. And B, you know, what a sweetheart of a professional, right?
Yeah.
You know, and he came in, and I swear to God, is this the most tear-jerking episode of Leverage ever?
It has to be, because I watch every episode 3 times. And the second one, I always watch the commentary, but the first and the second ones, I was crying. Mm-hmm. And I've seen this episode several times, but I was just like,
Yeah, that scene at the end, and he sells it so well. He's so freaking good. And you know, this is probably not at all a thing, but I look at the woman who played his wife, and I look at Some Kind of Wonderful, and I kind of see a brunette Watts.
Yeah, yeah. So, short hair, stubborn, angry.
I just kind of like, you know, that's probably just completely coincidental, but I like it anyway.
Yeah, yeah. That's fine with me. I get with that. Okay, should we go into the episode?
Yes.
Okay. And then if anything else comes up from that or from what we're thinking, we'll jump into it. So we open with a video from Eric Stoltz to his wife. And I also love that when you look up Leverage on IMDb, like, that's the image. Like, right? I was like, he wanted to be uncredited. He did it as a favor. And they're like, IMDb's like, this is who you should know you're going to see at some point.
Yeah. I mean, Academy Award winner Timothy Hutton is the star of the show, and that's the image they use. I mean, it's hilarious.
Funny. So his name is Alan Scott, which is also the name of one of the Green Lanterns. And he's chiding his wife for working when she could be climbing this mountain with him. And then oddly, a cell phone video sizzles out into like white noise static, which I thought was a little weird.
Which is again like 80s television sets after you don't have any transmission after, you know, 1 o'clock in the 2 o'clock in the morning or whatever it was.
Yeah. But you know, it works. I thought it worked for like being ominous, like this is the last time we see him.
Yeah.
And then we see a helicopter landing at base camp of Mount Kibari, a fictional mountain in Alaska at 8,000 feet above sea level.
Super Bond opening, by the way.
Yes.
Very Bond.
I love in the commentary, they're like, and we're actually on Mount Hood because it was right there. Like, why not? What you got.
Right? I was looking at that helicopter and I was thinking, this has got to be practical, because I was thinking back on the effects in the Mile High job. And as much as I love the Mile High job, that airplane is like bad.
Yeah.
It's really bad. So it's like, yay, we've got a practical. Okay.
it's just a remote controlled plane from far away.
not VFX. Yay.
Oh, man. So Elliot pulls up on a snowmobile and he is not happy, but I mean, Elliot's rarely happy. Right. But we find out that this is almost right after the finale. So it's right after the San Lorenzo stuff.
2 weeks.
And they're supposed to take 2 weeks off to lay low and everything because they just put Damien Moreau away forever. But Nate says the job has a specific window of opportunity. But they like drop a little bit of knowledge. They're like, he's like, hey, you climbed in the service, right? So we know that Elliot is a seasoned mountain climber on top of everything else that he can do.
Yes, which is everything.
Of course. We also get a flashback to Karen Scott, the wife of Alan, coming in to talk about his disappearance and like about his background. So we get to know him a little more. Like, not that we already weren't like fully invested in this sweet red haired man on a mountain.
Right.
Being in love with climbing, but you know, we'll find out.
Being in love with climbing and his wife.
Yes. yeah, you know, we find out he grew up in Kansas, and like the first time he ever climbed a mountain, it was like going into another world. And then, so like, not only is that adorable and they met climbing, but also he started a small investment firm to help small businesses, like his family's farm. And right. You're just like, what a good man. But then you find out he partnered up with this kind of skeezy financial, Merced Financial Services, and which is owned by this guy named John Drexel. And he's like, okay, well, Nate's like, I don't know what I can do to help you. Your husband went missing on this mountain last year. He's dead. Like, what do I do? But she says there's something wrong at Merced Financial, and that Alan had told her they were seizing properties they didn't own. And Nate says, oh yeah, that's, you know, that's robo-signing, which was like literally in the midst of happening.
Yes.
When this was airing. It was like right in the middle of all of this.
True to their ripped from the headlines ethos, but with you know, scams instead of murder, you know, very similar to Law and Order. Yes, it was very much a thing that was happening. And yeah, I don't, it's funny, I didn't read the question post on John Rogers' old blog, Kung Fu Monkey, to see if people were going, people really do that? Because I think at the time it was really heavily in the news, but probably some dumb person said, oh, that doesn't happen.
Yeah, I was, and I'll put the link in the story or the episode notes, but yeah, it was 2010, like late 2010, it was really coming out. So if this aired in June or July 2011,
yeah,
most people probably knew about it. It's still, I still don't quite understand it. And I feel so dumb saying that, but I'm like, I like read all the explanations of it. And I'm like, okay. I guess mostly it's because I'm like, that's horrible. Why would you do that?
Because people are horrible.
Because people are horrible.
Yes.
Which is something that you learn over and over again. And sometimes it just doesn't sink in.
Right. It's funny. It's funny that, you know, watching this show, you can still sometimes go, why? because, you know, you want to believe that people are better than this.
Yeah.
Oftentimes they just aren't. But then shortly after we get this backstory, we get the gang back together. We get our OTP3 saying hello to each other. And we get, you know, Hardison trying to be cuddly with the world and Parker being clueless and Elliot being, again, very grumpy.
Yes.
And then we get Hardison, a classic Hardisonian, saying, danger cupcake with murder icing.
Yes, because we get then a flashback back to like Nate planning this thing. He's like, we can't do this. Like, this is super dangerous.
Yes.
And Parker's like, shh.
Yeah.
They're like, can you climb mountains first? She's like, shh, I climb skyscrapers. I can walk up a mountain.
Right. And then Elliot with a very good point about avalanches not exactly occurring on skyscrapers.
He's like, no, that would be so cool. Right. How do I rig that? But I also loved, okay, so the danger cupcake with murder icing, because Elliot has just told us that everyone was supposed to separate and lie low for 2 weeks before they got back together. And yet Hardison is with Nate planning this back at the house, because Hardison, like, Nate is his dad. He never leaves that apartment.
But just also,
like we saw in the first episode or the second episode, when they like get back together for their next heist, like Hardison has been there the whole time setting up Leverage HQ. Like, he just stays there.
But also, he's, you know, to Parker's point, Parker's big emotional beat in this whole show, he's there to help.
Mm-hmm.
He's absolutely 100% there to help. And I know we'll get to Parker's amazing scene later, but yeah, I mean, it's really interesting how they kind of steer into that line.
Yeah. Let's see. So we find out Nate thinks that Alan Scott's body is probably only a few hours above base camp. So it's just a quick little jog up the mountain to like retrieve this man's body and the evidence.
Right.
Because she thinks Karen Scott thinks that he has like his notebook on him with some evidence.
Right.
But the mountain, yeah, go ahead.
So on the blog, one of the things he says is people almost making it back is a heartbreaking standard of climbing tragedy stories.
Mm.
So apparently this is a very, very common thing to happen.
Yeah. There's one of my favorite comedians is like what other sport is there where you just like leave the people who won, where people die regularly and where you just leave them there?
Well, yeah, I mean, Hardison is like, there's just dead bodies all over this mountain. That's disgusting.
Why? That's, yeah. Okay. But yeah, so the mountain's been closed since he died. There was a big blizzard right afterward and it all iced up. So they closed it for climbing. And if they're the first people on the mountain when it reopens, then they can find his body, find the notebook and all this stuff. But everybody else is waiting at base camp until there's like a this blizzard clear so that everybody can start their climbs up the mountain. And of course Nate wants to send Elliot and Parker up in the storm. Just like, just come on, y'all.
Yeah, you're the tough fit duo.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's Sophie who's like, why are we doing this? Like, why are we focused on this? And Nate's like, you know, Merced Financial is throwing 1,000 families a day mm-hmm. out of their homes with this robo signing. And that's not okay.
No.
Ugh. Also, back when I was looking up the robo-signing thing, like, crisis, the odd was, like, 1 in 248 homes yeah. had this happen to them.
Yeah. I had a friend who it happened to, who, she was able to fight it.
Good.
She'd kept really good records, and, you know, because that was part of the problem, is that sometimes, you know, people just, they trust that somebody else that the paperwork is basically ironclad. And
yeah.
that they don't have to hold on to that kind of stuff.
Makes yeah. me realize I need to be better about that too.
Yeah, it's really important.
Yeah. Okay, so Hardison's cover, so that he has control of all of the technology, is he's part of the U.S. Meteorological Survey, so he can control all the comms and everything because the internet is not getting quite all the way up to the top of the mountain.
Of course not. Not quite.
And yeah. And then they also establish that there are a bunch of dudes running around in like red parkas. And Nate's like, oh, those are the Rangers. And they have to clear Drexel and his team before they can go up the mountain.
Right.
But which Elliot.
It makes it convenient for them to be right there on the scene when everything goes down.
And we know who they are and that right. they do have authority here. So Hardison explains that Scott had a locator beacon on him and he's giving Hardison or Elliot and Parker, the receiver, a receiver, so when they get close, he can lead them right to him.
Mm-hmm.
While Sophie distracts him in this tent, and she's like, oh my gosh, it's like Christmas, because there's
Grifter
like...
Christmas.
Because there's Christmas. Drunk, rich men who are just like looking to waste money and be reckless. She's like, oh yes. And Nate says, let's go steal a mountain.
They're
getting.
Like, yeah. We did that already.
Yeah, come on, come up with another one. But Nate is not doing well at this point.
No.
He is suffering from some major altitude sickness, along with the fact that he quit drinking before he
And finished. Or that's Elliot's point. It's either alcohol withdrawal or it's altitude sickness. And can you tell the difference? Or is it both? And it leads the way to Elliot's fantastic line, you're good at your job, but you can't con a mountain.
Yeah. Ooh, a mountain doesn't care about your swagger, you know? You can't.
No.
Poor Nate, he looks rough in this episode.
Yes. Just as a side note, one of the things that my husband and I did recently too is, and I might have even mentioned this, 2 years ago when we started doing this podcast, we have on DVD the Nero Wolfe Mysteries.
Oh, nice.
Which is also a Timothy Hutton joint.
Mm-hmm.
And he's so much younger in that. And it was him and Maury Chaykin. He played Archie and Maury Chaykin played Nero Wolfe. And if anybody has a chance to either get it from their local library or, you know, if they can find it to purchase or to rent, it's really marvelous, especially if you like historical period pieces that have absolutely stunning costumes and sets and cars, because it's just gorgeous. And it's very funny. And Archie is not too dissimilar in some ways to Nate.
Oh, okay.
The character. He's got a little more like, you know, 1930s, kind of going on. But for the most part, you know, he's got a lot of swagger and he's got a lot of, you know, doesn't really care what anybody else thinks. And mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very good.
Yeah, I still haven't gotten around to watching those and I really should.
They're fun.
Okay, so let's see. Oh, before Parker and Elliot go up, Hardison's like, maybe I should go with you to try to protect you. And what? She's like, what? He's like, there might be polar bears. She's like, what are you going to do to a polar bear?
She's like, what?
And then right before, malware to it? No.
Yeah. And then right before they leave, Elliot hugs him.
Yes. Cause he like opens his arms wide for Parker to hug him. And she just is like, all right, bye.
Yeah. She goes up. And apparently, according to the blog, that was improvised on Christian Kane's part.
Amazing. And then at least Elliot hugged me, was improvised on Albataj's part, because they're so good. And this episode, because we said it before the episode really started, but like this episode is so important to my like little shipper heart of the three of them.
Yeah.
This is where it's all coming together. Mm-hmm. We had a really long hug between them at the beginning. We have this like random hug out of nowhere.
Right. From Grumpy Elliot.
And Grumpy Elliot's like, all right, man.
One notable the dog not barking in the night kind of thing about this particular episode.
Mm-hmm.
It is completely absent a damn it, Hardison.
That's true. We don't have a damn it, Hardison. We do have a very distinctive something.
We have a very distinctive footprint.
We have a let's go steal a something.
Yep.
Hardison. But no, we have not yet seen the handshake really appear.
That wasn't, I don't think, quite as constant. I think.
Well, because I think it's later, but I feel like in the last couple seasons, because I know they do it in the office job, which is this season. But yeah, I've been like waiting kind of for that. Let's see. Then we get Karen Scott just showing up out of the snow. And she wants to help, you know, right? Like they're trying to get this information to like for her husband and all this stuff. And Nate's like, you're too emotionally involved. That leads to bad decisions.
Hardison is like, do you hear yourself?
Did you just say that with a straight face?
Yes.
And what? So Nate just like is like, here's a comm so you can hear what we're doing and stay here in our internet cafe tent so that Drexel doesn't see you and so we don't get caught.
And let me say, as somebody who grew up in a cold climate, this particular episode makes me so cold because of all the times when, and I know we need to show people's faces, mm-hmm. and I know we need to, you know, we can't have people bundled up the way they should be because it's television, and you can't have a bunch of people completely muffled, you know, from head to foot. But every time somebody took off their gloves outside for no reason, I was like, put your freaking gloves back on! It's freezing.
Yeah. And I don't really have that frame of reference. So I'm like, I guess when people say it's cold, they're not really that cold.
I grew up in New Hampshire. And then I also lived in Minnesota for a while. So I know from cold. Mm. And it's, you don't mess around with a lot of exposed skin. And you zip your jacket entirely. And you don't mess around with that stuff. Because frostbite is not fun.
And it's real. It's real. Especially if you're on a mountain during a blizzard.
Right. Oh, as is hypothermia. And so all of these like really flimsy tents, I was just like, oh.
Yeah.
Bless them, budget.
Yeah. And I wonder what base camps on mountains like these are like. Because I think this is, you know, it is kind of a base camp that they're set up in. But I don't know if the internet tent is. I have no idea.
No idea either.
So Sophie's inside, and I love this, getting intel, and she needs intel on the teams, and Hardison just has, like, the stats, but Karen's able to, like, fill her in on, like, the personalities and stuff, and then, oh my gosh, when she meets Drexel for the second time.
Yes.
So good.
It is so good, and I have to, one of my notes here was, I just lose track of everything when Sophie is working people. Cause I realized I haven't taken any notes just cause I'm fascinated by watching Gina Bellman become different people right in front of my face.
Yeah. And she becomes three or four different people in this tent where everyone is around her. Like,
right.
Going back to her house, putting a different outfit on in a different crowd. No.
At one point later in the episode, she literally borrows somebody else's parka, tucks her hair into the hood, slips on a pair of glasses, and talks to a guy she's just talked to like 2 hours before, and he doesn't recognize her at all. And here's my thesis for why that works.
Okay.
Sexism. Yes. Because the first time she approaches him, she's all, good dog, I am the sexy gentleman. Hi.
Have some schnapps.
Cool. Danke. And he sees her just purely as a sex object. Mm-hmm. And the second time she comes up to him, she's like all sort of, it's basically, she's, you know, as I'm sure you and I both being librarians, we really hate this idea of the stereotype, but it's sort of the sexy librarian, or not the non-sexy part of the sexy librarian stereotype, yeah. Which is, you know, the all buttoned up, you know, hair isn't visible, you know, wearing glasses, which, you know, I'm here looking at your gorgeous glasses and thinking, no, glasses are not code for not sexual, but you know, anyway, yeah. I think that's a large part of why that flip works, is because she plays two like radically different characters,
and her like the expression, like she comes over and she even takes a thing of schnapps from him again, so she does a shot again,
yeah,
but she's like frustrated and she's sighing and she's like, ugh, you know, yeah. She's obviously like annoyed about something, so it's like, but her face is the same. He wasn't looking at her face very close.
Oh, he was not looking at her face, and she knew that.
Yeah. And she's like, Henzi, and she just like gets out of the
Oh, place. That was the other dude.
Oh, that's true. That was the Japanese guy.
That was
in my sweater.
Yes, that was the Japanese lawyer. That was,
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I just love watching Gina Bellman just essentially transform herself into several different characters within the space of a scene.
Mm-hmm.
It fascinates me.
And then I love later when Sophie like talks about like how she breaks it down, because she does it at the end of the episode.
Yes.
And I'm like, how do you like when you say it like that, I understand, but like how do you think like that on your feet? I cannot do that.
Well, I think a lot of it is not necessarily, you know, we see something like that and we see it as thinking on their feet, you know. And let's just take a really banal example again from our own lives. You know, we're at the reference desk and somebody asks us a question and we say, they're looking for something, they can't find it. Mm-hmm. And as a librarian, you know, one of your first questions is, well, what have you already done? So you don't necessarily run over the same
line
of inquiry. And they tell you this and, you know, immediately you've got, it, you know, usually at least three different possible avenues for looking for it, based on what you know from experience, because you've done this a bunch of times. Yeah. And that's what Sophie is doing. She has basically a library of personality types in her head and sort of the leverage with which to manipulate them. Mm-hmm. And so it's not necessarily her so much. It's not creating out of whole cloth. It's she's thinking on her feet, absolutely, yeah. But she also is working from a lot of experience. So I think that's
true.
That's why they call it competence porn.
that's so true. Oh, we haven't brought up that term in a while. But yeah, I know she's been doing it forever. And yeah, and if you take it down, like there are these types of people, and then you can like fine tune it for each person that you have to pull that specific con on. Okay. Yes. It just blows my mind, which, yeah. I mean, like I can like rein in a rowdy story time group, but I could not do this, you know?
I'm not saying it's easy. She's not like creating these character profiles and how they can be manipulated on the fly. You know,
yeah.
this is something that, you know, and you can appreciate skill and practice and effort. Absolutely. I'm not saying that's certainly valuable. It's not like, you know, Olympic athletes are just, you know, winging it.
Right.
We're like, appreciating their skill and their practice and their,
That's really true. That's really true. Okay. So Elliot and Parker have been climbing the mountain and they've found the high camp, which is like just an orange tent.
Right.
Hanging out. And it's like a supply depot. It's got first aid and it's got oxygen tanks. and which is very good. So now we know what this is later on. Right. I love there's so much like obvious info dumping in this episode, which I think is very important because not a lot of people climb giant mountains.
No, I don't. That's for sure.
I was like, thank you. I need to know who those men in the red jackets are. Thank you. I need to know why there's a random tent here.
Right, right.
So because they've hit this high camp, they should be getting close because just above this is where they lost Alan Scott. But Hardison's not getting a ping off his beacon. So he thinks they might need to send another climber up to triangulate the signal.
Right.
And Nate doesn't want to do that, but Elliot notices some footprints and he knows there's a Russian up there with them.
Because it's a very distinctive footprint.
And Parker's just like, seriously?
Right.
Really? It's like, what? I know this stuff. So Drexel, back in the tent, he sends out a text that Hardison matches. And we find out that it's to somebody else at base camp. And and then I didn't finish that. And then I went on to the next scene. So I don't know what
probably the reason why you didn't really go into it is this, the substance of it is essentially that he's... It starts to give them the breadcrumbs to lead to the conclusion that he's trying to sell his company to this Japanese company or consortium. I can't remember which it was. It doesn't really matter. So to basically get out from under of the liability of what he's been doing.
Gotcha. Okay. That's
the long, is that this is my former corporate side of my background.
I think it was also like they get the text. Hardison is like, oh, it's one of the competitors, and then they realize Karen's gone, and so I was just writing stream of consciousness. So
it was also part of the distractions that Karen needed in order to slip out and elude them and hike off into the snow to deliver the beacon.
Which, as an experienced climber, I mean, maybe they should trust her, but Nate's like, No,
little lady. He sometimes has those moments.
Yeah, like, and we're like, you are already suffering from many, many symptoms.
Right.
That are not conducive to climbing.
Right. But so right. He knows.
So he's just leaving Sophie and Hardison to figure out this Drexel thing, which, as you said, is that he is trying to sell his company. If this Japanese company buys it, then they have like really, really strict, strong privacy laws in Japan. So all of the robocalling and the foreclosure stuff will be hidden behind that wall and he'll just walk away.
Right.
Ugh. So, So Sophie decides she's changing up the game. And then she like does her transformation and talks to the Germans.
Right.
And like lets it slip that the Japanese are going to buy Merced. So they sell their stocks, and so the stock price is, like, going to plummet. Meanwhile, Nate, chivalrous Nate, makes it to the high camp, and he gets some oxygen because he is not doing well. And then he, you know, he's looking for Karen. But thanks to her having gone up there, they can now, like, Hardison's been able to triangulate where Alan Scott is. But Parker and Elliot are like, there's nothing here. It's just snow.
Right.
Until they yell, they hear something, and then they yell, crevasse, and they fall.
Is that what they yell? I have in my notes, what is do they yell before the cave collapse?
I'm pretty sure, I have bought all of the seasons, or as we've been going, I've been buying the seasons on DVD, because I have to watch the commentary. Like, do not think I could do this without the commentary, because I love it so much. But the first three seasons did not have closed captionings or subtitles, which was really upsetting to me. Season 4 has subtitles. They do yell crevasse.
Crevasse. Okay. That's a little specific.
Well, I mean, it is what they fell into.
Yeah, I would be more like,
Well, that's because we're not them.
We're not them. This is true.
As they point out later, that's like a special subset of person.
Right.
I hate that. So then Hardison loses their signal and is, you know, freaking out a little. And Nate finds Karen's unconscious body. So actually it's a good thing that he needed to be macho and follow her up the mountain.
Yes.
And he gives her his oxygen and then passes out. And then he also, like, when I was writing my notes, I had to stop at that point and like leave. So I was like, I hate leaving on this cliffhanger. It was my third time to watch it this week.
And still.
So he wakes up again in the high high camp tent because Karen is a BAMF and like twisted ankle or knee or something, woke up with the oxygen mask, then dragged this unconscious man who's like twice her size.
Right, because she's tiny.
She's small. Down this mountain and into this tent and like gave him oxygen.
It was down. You know, she at least had gravity on her side. I don't know.
She's just rolling down the hill.
Yeah, she rode him like a toboggan. That's not the one.
It's like that movie with Daniel Radcliffe. I haven't seen it, but the trailer is terrifying to me. God, what is it called? Swiss Army Man.
I don't know about this.
Go look at the trailer later.
I should break in right now and say, so I have a TiVo, and so normally I watch things on my TiVo. Mm. We boot past the commercials with a quickness. Yeah. And I have now this on through IMDb through Amazon Prime. It's some sort of weird subset of Amazon Prime. But so now I've got it for the sunk cost of my Amazon Prime account.
Yay.
But it does have ads, which I am, you know, last night my husband and I we did the first watch. I only do two watches, but my husband and I did the first watch together. And we have a sort of a slightly complicated AV setup in our den, and he's trying at different things. He's like, you can't even mute these.
Oh my God, what? No.
We probably could have muted it on our stereo, which is where the sound comes through, but it's like, we couldn't mute it on the TiVo remote. It was weird.
Oh my God.
And they were, and a lot of these commercials are very, very, very strange. Folgers Coffee Company has, first of all, they have this like sort of noir, like murder mystery or drug bust, really kind of ads for this new premium coffee that they're selling. It's like some date 18 something, I don't know.
Okay.
And it's very kind of over the top, and it's intended to be very silly, but it's just like, and then at the end, you know, like you've got this incredible sort of this trippy sort of film noir, you know, thing where people are getting busted for having coffee. then okay. At the end, it says something like, you know, by Folgers, and it's like Crystal's people, the instant coffee people.
Yeah.
You know? Really? And then they've got a different, like more regular Folgers thing, which basically has, it's just this weird, we had this weird Christmas thing with like dad was pretending to be Santa and he's now stuck in the chimney and there's like his feet are sticking out and they're not helping him. They're like poking him with stuff. It's weird. It's weird, I'm telling you.
All right, Folgers. Weird flex, but okay. What? That's very strange.
Very, very strange.
So yeah, no choice but to watch these in their entirety with the sound all the way up. That is some futuristic BS right there.
Oh, and then we also saw Knives Out a couple of days ago at the movie theater. And so
I'm seeing it this afternoon. So no spoilers.
No spoilers. No, this is not about this. It's not about that movie at all. But there's, you know, because there is a, because of course we have to not only have ads, but we have to have fairly interminable trailers these days, but, you know, for movies that we might never be interested in seeing. And let me tell you, one kind of movie I'm never interested in seeing is a war movie. Mm. And there's a World War I movie coming out with like every single British actor you've ever heard of.
Plus all of the One Direction guys, right?
I don't know. I don't know.
No, there's the one.
I'm too old for that. I don't know who those people are. And so that's another one of the ads. Thankfully, it's not the entire, like, I don't know how many minute trailer I had to sit through Knives Out the other day, but it's like, you know, there's a lot of Colin Firth basically going, you know, if you don't get through, then 16,000 men will die and your brother's among them. Oh, joy. Thanks.
I just wanted to go to my lighthearted heist caper. Thank you.
Lighthearted heist caper, the episode of which makes me cry my eyes out because.
Yeah, but I want to get back to that, not the Great War.
Not trench warfare, thank you very much. Yeah.
Not mustard gas, no thank you. Oh, I love that we got, not distracted, but like went off on that very important tangent, because I do think it's important for people who maybe they're not rewatching the show as we go through the series that they can if they get on IMDb TV.
Yes.
Do you think it works without the Amazon Prime account?
I have no idea. You clued me into it a couple months ago, I think, and I looked into it, and basically I just did a Google.
Okay.
And so it might be possible just to get it through, you know, your computer. I was able to watch it on my television.
Oh, nice.
Because I could run the, you know, I've got Amazon Prime on my TiVo and I could run that, that along. But yeah, I really don't know. So I encourage, I encourage people to try a Google on IMDb. It's called IMDb TV.
Yeah. And I think you can just go to the IMDb site and get to it from there. But, I don't know. I've got Amazon Prime, so I don't know if it would just immediately sign me in to my account.
I can't remember if I had to sign up separately or what, but if you do have Amazon Prime and you want to get it that way, if you Google Amazon Prime IMDb TV, you will find a page that tells you if you need to do anything or not. I honestly don't recall at this point.
Yeah. So I wanted to go back because this scene with Karen and Nate in the high tent, the high camp tent, is so good.
Yeah.
It's another, it didn't make me cry like later in the episode does, but it gives me a lot of feelings because it's really this, like, what is Nate's arc going to be for this season?
Right.
And they're like laying it out for us. Cause he, you know, she's kind of apologizes cause she, you know, we find out that she twisted her ankle and kept walking on it and hyperventilated and that's why she passed out.
Right.
And, you know, she admits that she was so angry that it blinded her judgment. So even though she's an experienced climber,
right,
like going into it like this, it clouded her judgment. And he's like, yeah, I understand. I really, really understand where you're coming from.
I get it.
If anybody could, it's Nate Ford.
Right.
You know, and she's like, it's not fair that he died. And he says, it's never fair.
Nope.
But the anger is easier than the grief. But he warns her to be careful because if you let the anger drive you, it will blind you and get you into trouble over and over again, just so you can feel something, to beat something. I'm just like, oh, Nate, again, are you aware of what you're saying?
Is this about Nate or is this about her? Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And you know, Nate's like, but I'm too smart to let it, you know, get me. But, you know, she's like, what happens then? And he says, well, then you do it until you run into something that you can't beat.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's like a mountain. And then.
Can't climb a mountain.
Then and then your luck is out and it's a long way down. Which you're like, look at you guys. Name in the episode. I see what you did there. Which is also something that comes back, which is going to be a theme for this episode and for, I think, this whole season.
Yeah.
And then as he says long way down, it fades and we see down to the bottom of this cave where Parker and Elliot have fallen, which I was also like, that's on the crevasse. It's also on the nose.
Yes. And Parker with the strobing flashlight, okay?
Now, Elliot, wake up.
there's no mention of that in the blog post that I was looking for because last night when my husband and I were watching it for the first time, I was like, oh God, that looks so much like he must have been an ad lib from her. And my husband noted that with survival rescue flashlights, they do cycle through, you know, several, like a few different settings. And one of them is a strobe. And he's like, it could have just happened that like she goes to turn it on. And that happened to be the setting. It was the actress, it happened to be the setting that was on and it was just completely unintentional. She ran with it.
Yeah.
But it's hilarious.
I wonder if that is helpful in waking up someone, though.
I don't think it has anything to do with waking people up. I think it has to do with finding someone. It's easier to find, you know, if something is flashing, it's easier to...
Oh, so if you got, if you were injured, you could, like, let it on that, that setting to be a beacon for other people. Okay.
Right.
Wow, I love that. But it definitely wakes Elliot up, and it makes him grumpy.
Makes him grumpy?
Okay.
He wakes up. He wakes up grumpy every day, no matter what.
That's true. That is very true. So they examine, they get up, and remarkably, they're neither of them are injured. They are wearing helmets and stuff, but there's no twisted ankles or, broken arms, which I would, maybe they know how to fall properly. I would not.
I think, first of all, they both are very, very experienced physical people, and they do know how to fall properly. And I don't think Elliot was actually knocked out. I don't think he's waking up. I think he's just kind of like recovering from getting the wind knocked out of him, which, having had that happen to me, oh boy, howdy, it can take you a minute.
No.
Terrible feeling.
Yes. So they get up and they're kind of examining. They're looking up to see how far they fell and like looking around where they are, and they find a red tarp, and it's covering a body. Yep. And it's blue Eric Stoltz.
It is blue Eric Stoltz holding his breath.
Yes. And not moving his eyes at all.
Nope.
I think that'd be the hardest part for me, pretending to be like a corpse would be like not moving my eyes under my eyelids. Be like, that person's not asleep, they're in REM.
Right, exactly.
So they, they see that his leg was broken, so there was no way that he could have gotten out. And Elliot's like, it's going to be hard enough getting us out of here. He was on his own, and he had a broken leg. Like,
right.
No, it was a death trap. And that's another reason why they couldn't get his beacon signal, is because he was trapped by these stone walls, and then the storm froze him in.
Right.
And then Parker, Elliot's like, all right, let's go. And Parker's like, we have to take the body. We have to take him.
Right.
And I think that is like a big... This episode is such a turning point for so many people, because, I mean, we haven't seen Parker deal with too many dead bodies, but never before would I have thought, oh yeah, this makes sense for her character to be like, we've got to take this, like salvage this person.
Because it's a total move forward for her character.
Yeah.
It's a total, it's just her wanting to emulate the people she admires.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, again, in the blog post, somebody asked about, does she feel remorse for things that she has done in the past that were not as selfless? And he said, no, this is about moving forward. This is not about making amends.
Yeah. And that's also what they've said about Elliot's character.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of Elliot's character last season was him, like, I guess coming to grips with all the horrible things that he has done, mm-hmm. for Moreau, or, for the army, or for whatever.
Right.
And now, like, if we focus on that, then we'll never, like, we'll be paralyzed. So this is about moving forward and doing the good that you can moving forward. And in their case, they can do a lot of good.
Yeah.
So yeah. I don't think it's not, like, it's the red in their ledger, to borrow from Marvel, but
comics, no.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. One of the notes I had here is Parker's character arc the most interesting / extreme of the whole team? I mean, because they all get interesting character arcs, but I happen to think that Parker's is the most interesting.
Oh, 100%.
I didn't think it was necessarily going to be an unpopular opinion.
This wasn't going to be up for debate.
No. But it's interesting, because when I first, I think back to that first scene, when I first saw that actress, and I didn't know what the show was going to be like, and I actually bought her kind of the least of the mm-hmm. team. I, because she came off as so kind of Daffy Duck, bouncing off all of, aside from her precise skills, I saw her personality being just kind of a little bit too wild cardy.
And one note, like, I felt she was really flat in the first episode.
Mm-hmm. And I thought that she actually, she got better even within that first episode. I've watched the premiere episode, I don't know how many times. I've overanalyzed it maybe a little bit too much, but that actress grew into that role
mm-hmm.
so much. And in ways that I could not have predicted when I first saw her.
Yeah.
I had never seen her in anything before.
Yeah. I don't know. I should look up Beth Rees Graff a little more. But I 100% agree. Like, I think I told you in the first episode that we recorded, like, I didn't like Parker in the first episode. I was, because she's like, everybody else is a little more complex. Like, we're seeing Nate's story, like Sophie, we see she's bad on stage, but she's great at the con. Like, Elliot is, you know what you're getting sort of with Elliot, and but also he's more like emotionally mature, and he like he can like read people as well. And Hardison's like just charming, and that's like my favorite type of character.
Yeah,
with her, I was just like, is it because she's pretty and blonde? Like, why is this character here? Like, why is she here? And it's not like that helps, but she is so good, and that character has so much growth that like then at the end she's like your favorite, and you see, and I don't want to like spoil the last episode, but like the way that it ends, you're just like, this is that's good.
The other thing too that I remember thinking about watching that very first episode was that Parker to me was less of a character and more of a litmus test for the other characters. How are they going to react to her? Because there's a worse television show, worse writer's room would have had each of them kind of responding kind of in the same way.
Her.
And each of them was from the get-go was very, very specific and different. And, you know, Hardison from the get-go was just blown away by her, you know, attracted to her, yes, but he could also tell he appreciated her skills. Elliot was, for the most part, you know, the reaction you'd kind of expect, you know, that's 10 pounds of crazy in a 5-pound bag. And I don't think I recall Sophie really interacting that much with her in that very first episode.
I think at the very end when they're like walking in the park, like she said something, and she's just like
the shoes thing,
and she's just like, what, like, I need to help you.
and that's set up the kind of, you know, if there's not really a female equivalent of the word avuncular, but that's kind of their relationship. Sort of big sisterly kind of relationship. And then, you know, Nate was just he knew what she could do. And he wasn't really reacting to her personality. He was reacting to her almost as a tool. And
that's what they all were in that first episode.
Yes, but her more than anybody else, I think, because she didn't really require any emotional handholding or rationalizations or anything like that, the way the other characters did. And now look where she is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Things and thinking about morality and, you know, and who would have guessed that?
Yeah. And also like thinking about morality and accepting these things about yourself means that you can move forward in your other relationships and become closer to people.
Yes.
Even when you're not necessarily doing the good thing all the time.
Right.
It's amazing. Like, it's really good. It's so good.
Okay.
Definitely could talk about Parker and her growth all day long. But Hardison doesn't know that she's going through this emotional, you know, burst of growth, because he's freaking out because he's trying to reach everyone and nobody's getting the signals except Sophie, and it's driving her up the wall.
Oh, and by the way, so she and Sophie goes through this thing where she's, you know, she's trying to stall our baddie from doing anything. And she says, check your stock price. And he says, I can't. And the way she says, just give it a sec. And she nails on that last.
Because he like grabs her and he's like, what are you doing? Like,
right.
Because she's also at this point, she talks to the Japanese about the buyout and the, but she's also like, I'm running low on cons. Like, we gotta wrap this up soon. I can only be so many more people.
Right. I'm in this tiny little party tent with these, like, you know, 30 men.
So it's going to jump, I guess, as it always does, it's going to jump back between the characters in different scenes. Parker finds Alan's phone, and the cold has managed to save the battery, which, of course, they researched, and it would have lasted, probably.
I always thought that made batteries die faster.
No, I remember, like, back in the day, you would keep batteries in the fridge or the freezer.
There is that, I guess. Anyway, I trust them. I trust, and you know, also remember, we've got black box versus ledger here. It doesn't really matter.
Exactly. I mean,
they can, there's only so much you can do when you're constructing these kinds of stories in 42 minutes. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have some ledger, you know, factoids, things that aren't really real.
Yeah. And I don't want all this stuff to be real.
No.
Then the world's even worse.
Yeah. The fact that the cons are all real. The names for them, when he comes.
Yeah, the Moscow Circus Con.
You're the Ivan.
Love it. I don't know if that's be real. They also find a video for his wife on the phone, and you just see like the first 2 seconds of it, but you know, Elliot's like, that's for his wife. Like, we're not going to watch that. And then, you know, then they're trying to figure out how they're going to get out and get. Elliot calls him the body, and she's like, Alan. His name is Alan.
Yeah.
So we get Nate and Karen are coming back down the mountain. So we have their like GPS signal, but they haven't been able to talk through the comms yet. And there's a storm coming in.
Presumably, she's riding him like a toboggan again.
Again, of course. with her twisted ankle. There's a storm coming in, and that's wreaking havoc on all the radio signals. So we have Drexel figuring out Sophie's up to something, and you know, she does the just give it a sec, which means, you know, Hardison's listening, and he's like, oh, okay, I'll turn on his phone now.
Exactly.
And he's like, who are you? Like, cause she's like, we're gonna buy out your company because now everybody else is like, your stock price is dropping. And then Nate and Karen enter the tent, and Drexel does a piss poor job of acting sympathetic. He's like, Karen, what are you doing here? I mean, I'm so sorry for your loss.
Right.
Okay. And Sophie runs up and kisses Nate so she can tell him that they're running the Moscow Circus Con.
And that he's the Ivan.
Which, what? And he's like, I'm kind of dying of altitude sickness right now. She's like, we'll make it fast. So good. So while trying to get out, Elliot and Parker, their rope snaps. And this means they're going to be short of rope. So they have to take Alan's from him, and they're not going to be able to get him up. And
right.
Parker has her like breakdown. And she's like, she's adamant that they have to do the right thing because it's what Hardison and Sophie and Nate would do. And she wants to do the right thing. And she's crying. And I'm like, it's freezing cold. You can't cry right now.
And Elliot gives the best speech.
Yeah.
The best speech. It's just, it's so, you know, heartbreaking because he makes the point. He's like, yeah, they would have done that thing and they would not make it out of here. But we are us and we will make it out of here.
That's why they need us, because we have to make the hard decisions.
Yes. Yeah.
And she says, does that make us bad? And he's like, that makes us us.
Yeah.
And you can take that as a gift or as a curse.
Yeah.
It's up to you. I'm just like, so good.
For the people who can't see me, I just mime stabbing myself in the chest and twisting the knife. And here's another great quote from the Kung Fu Monkey blog, John Rogers, the showrunner of Leverage's blog. And for anybody who does not know about this, at the time this show was being aired, John Rogers kept a blog, and he would have people ask questions about episodes in his comments. And the next week he would answer them, and he would have these incredibly long encyclopedic blog posts with questions and answers that were fascinating. I mean, the stuff you could learn about writing, the stuff you could learn about television production, the weird details of all of the stuff that they learned. It was really amazing. But it's one of the things he wrote about the characters. Separately, they're kind of broken, and together they make one pretty decent human being.
Yeah. I like John Rogers is awesome. I love like the commentary, the blog, like he's not keeping all of like the vast information that he already has and that he learns. Like, he's not keeping it to himself. He's like, let me teach you about story structure. Let me teach you about character development. Let me teach you about plot points. Let me teach you about how you can cut these things out and like make the important things more important. And it's just like, why isn't he doing one of those master classes?
He should. Well, I don't know. I might have mentioned this on episode one, but it was a long time ago. But he was on, I used to listen avidly to it's a television writers podcast. It used to be called the Nerdist Writers Panel. I don't know if it's still under the Nerdist banner anymore, or even if that still exists anymore. I've gotten really out of a lot of my podcast listening, she said, on our podcast. it was a really great, many of the episodes were really great masterclasses in story structure and in specifically writing for television and writing in act structure. And he was on one episode of it many years ago, and it was just fantastic. I mean, I listened to that one episode probably three or four times just because he was so, so good. So for whatever that's worth, I would just like to just like in the middle of all of this, give a plug, and we kind of have done it, you know, tangentially, but to say thank you to John Rogers, generally speaking, for not only giving us this show, but for giving us things like his blog, where he explained all these things that happened, and the way he's available on Twitter to answer questions. And, you know, he's just a really decent human being.
Yeah. Yeah. It looks like that podcast was still going on. I think maybe the last episode went up in April 2018. Okay. So yeah, if I'm going to go back and find that. So
yeah.
Other people, if you want to listen to it as well. So Nate playing Ivan, he tells Drexel that Karen's given him the notebook. So they have all the information and the numbers and the passwords they need. And they're going to, get Drexel's company and everything. And Drexel is like, it looks like he's going to play ball, you know, but he wants to see the notebook before really anything goes down. Oh, wait, going back to the cave, before they leave, Parker wants to listen to Alan's message.
Right.
On the phone to make sure there's nothing that he wanted whoever found him to do before they left, which I thought was like really sweet. He's like, what if there's something he wants us to do with his body, or like,
right,
before we go, if there's any last thing. And they've also found his notebook. And we just see like the very beginning of it again, or we hear it again. And then we cut to them contacting Hardison up top, and Hardison is like understandably overwhelmed by the fact that they're both there again, and it seems like equally he's like, oh my god, Elliot, Parker, are you there too? Like, but he's, you know, he tells them they're his people. He's like, y'all are my people. And they're like, shut up. He takes oxygen and also listen to this.
Yes. Oxygen.
And we see Nate scolding Sophie for going really big with this con. But then Parker, or Hardison, interrupts him to tell him that Elliot and Parker are coming back down, and that he's going to play him the recording as well. And Nate leaves the tent to go to the internet tent, and Drexel sneaks up behind him and punches him in the face. But all I could think was that, like, Drexel must be like the worst punch ever, because Nate is like suffering from altitude sickness
and just completely shakes it off. Yeah,
and he doesn't even fall over. He's just like, why'd you do that? I'm like, this man just passed out on a mountain. He's climbed up and down. Like, he hasn't had a drink.
Drexel must have kitten paws.
Yes, he is not well. And you pathetic billionaire. So he's like, I don't believe that you have the notebook. And then he threatens his team with his Russian up on the mountain.
Right.
And then he says, if they give him the notebook, like, might even give them a ride down the mountain. But otherwise, So that's now we know that
there's a snowmobile in play.
Yeah. Now we know that when we find a snowmobile, it's the Russians, but he's nowhere in sight until he jumps out of the snow.
Yes.
Which is wild. And he grabs Parker and pulls a gun on her.
As a kid who grew up in New England, you can totally do that.
So the kid who grew up in Houston, like, what the hell?
Yeah, you can totally bury yourself in the snow and stay there for a short period of time. Yeah.
But then, like, explode out of it?
I suppose if you're a very incredibly strong, fit dude, and, you know, it's gonna fly everywhere. Snow is generally speaking, unless it's super wet and it's too cold, it would be too cold there for the snow to be very wet.
Okay.
So when snow crystals form, and I'm not a meteorologist, so I'm kind of winging, you know, the little bit of knowledge that I have, but when snow crystals form at higher temperatures, they tend to have more water packed in, and it's like that heavier, sludgier snow, slushier. Mm. And when it gets very cold, the ice crystals are very light and fluffy, and they are very, for instance, crappy for making snow, or they're crappy for making snowballs because they don't adhere.
Okay.
They're too dry.
That's why they call them powder. That's why they call it powder.
That's why it's called powder snow. And you notice when Elliot and Parker are going up the mountain, one of the things I was wondering about is we see Nate grab a pair of snowshoes, which seems logical if you're working in powder. I am, however, not a climber. I'm just a person who grew up in the snow. Okay. So and what they were doing, but Elliot and Parker did not have snowshoes. And
I thought I saw her with them on.
Well, what it really looked like to me, and what it looked like to my husband, who also grew up in New England with a lot of snow, is that what they were doing with it was called post-holing, which is essentially you have to lift up your leg really high to get over the snow, and then when you put it down, it kind of goes boom through several layers of snow. And it is exhausting, let me tell you.
Yeah.
Really exhausting. But given the state of really dry powder snow, jumping out of it would be dead easy. And it would also be easy to cover yourself up with it because A, you wouldn't suffocate.
Okay. Not really.
And it's easy to move around.
Okay.
So, you know, you can sort of push aside a large volume of snow very, very quickly and then just kind of pull it back over you. Almost like that SpongeBob gif where he's on the beach and he's like, falls backward into the hole and goes, nope.
Yes. Okay.
It's kind of like good
because I like have no frame of reference for this. And I'm like, whoa, this is some Russian magic.
Yeah. Well, Russians would know from snow too. So
it's true. So he grabs Parker, he pulls a gun. And Elliot has to give him the notebook, which then he burns with a flare right in front of them as he, and then takes off on the snowmobile as like, this is such a gorgeous, terrifying shot. Cause like he's leaving, going down the mountain and you see like the slope of the mountain and then like other mountains in the distance. And then you see these like those low storm clouds, like moving in and like the gray and the white. And like, it's so beautiful, but you're like, oh my God, get off the mountain.
Can you produce some skis somewhere now, please?
No. Where's our Nate toboggan?
Right. The Nate toboggan is already at the base camp.
Should be one at every post.
Right.
So, Drexel, I misspelled his name here and put Drezel, and I like that a lot. Yes. He goes into the internet camp tent and, tells Hardison to call up the Russian signal. And so we find out through that he's burnt the notebook and Drexel goes back in and he's all smug towards Nate and Karen. But before he can really do anything, Alan Scott's face appears on like all of the multiple screens that are in this tent.
Yes.
And it turns out the signal was bad where Parker and Elliot were, and they needed a way to get the signal down the mountain quickly. So they planted the phone in the Russian's pants.
right in the pocket of his ski pants.
Yeah, because when he's holding her hostage, I'm like, really? Parker's going to let someone hold her hostage? Are you kidding me? And then you're like, oh, okay. She meant to do it, which is great. And, you know, it starts off as a video for his wife that's lighthearted, and then it cuts to him saying, I'm going to die. Like, I don't think anybody's going to find me. And saying that Drexel
cut
his rope. And he's like, he says his first and last name because Drexel's like, nope, it wasn't me. It was another whatever his name is, John or something.
Right.
And, you know, then immediately the Rangers come in their red coats and they take the Russian who sees Elliot and Parker have arrived. And he's like, what? How did you? And then they come get Drexel as well. And Sophie's like, Hardison, how are you doing this? Like, how did you get it up on all the screens? And he's like, I'm not. Alan emailed the video to everyone before he died, but there wasn't enough signal until it came down the mountain.
Right.
And now it's all being delivered. So like, he's like from beyond the grave.
Right. Right.
Heading before, right.
Yeah. And by the way, you know, the first of all, Drexel says, this is putting my lawyer hat on now. Drexel says, oh no, this is hearsay. First of all, it's a recording, so it's not hearsay because it's not somebody else repeating his words. Mm-hmm. Second of all, Nate is in fact correct that a dying declaration is admissible in court. However, right. It would also be admissible if he was dying and he told his wife, and his wife said, my husband said that he cut the rope. That would also be admissible. Ooh. Because hearsay is not, I recorded this, usually. I recorded this, and especially if the person is no longer available.
Mm-hmm.
But it is like, if I told you and you told somebody else, you telling somebody else, that would be hearsay.
Yeah, but since we're hearing it straight from
his mouth.
Yeah, this guy doesn't know anything.
Nope.
And then like a deathbed confession also is good.
Deathbed confessions or just dying declarations in general are exceptions. So if I'm dying and I tell you Drexel cut the rope, and you go into court and you say, she told me Drexel cut the rope, objection, hearsay, exemption, or I can't remember what you're supposed to say back, but you know, dying declaration is admissible, sustain,
Okay.
Objection denied, go ahead.
Yeah, even though it's hearsay because I heard it from that person, it's not straight from that person because right. They were dying.
Existed. And you can edit out all this legal dorkery if you want to.
That's no, I love it. I live for this. The great things about having different people on is like everybody has different areas where they know stuff. Like I didn't know any of that shit about snow. Yes, but no, having people with different knowledge bases is so important. So you have like a nice, well-rounded podcast. So especially the lawyer stuff, because I don't know any of that.
Well, and generally speaking, Leverage really does get the lawyer stuff right, because I think Dean Devlin was a lawyer. No, Chris Downey was a lawyer.
Yes.
So I found that just a little bit weird, and maybe there's been some sort of electronic recording like rule or something like that since I went to law school, because I have not studied evidence in many years. So, you know, caveat if I miss something.
Yeah.
But in my experience, I wouldn't even be considered to be hearsay in the first place.
Okay.
But dying declaration is much shorter and simpler too for narrative purposes.
Yeah. Oh, then we have the last bit of the recording that he leaves for Karen, which is what gives us to cry so much.
Loves it.
And it is so good. These two actors apparently never actually met on set. They have no scenes together and they didn't, but it comes across like in the commentary, they're like, it just comes across like they knew each other though, like that they're actually talking and reacting to this person that they have loved.
Yeah.
And then the end, he says, don't come up here looking for me because I'm not up here. Right there with you, wherever you are. And I'm like, oh God. And it was like reminding me of this Christina Rossetti poem that I'm just should have looked up earlier. And
are you thinking of the ones don't mourn me for I have not left or something like that?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm just like Googling like Christina Rossetti poems, grave. There's too many.
Yeah.
A lot of poems about death. My girl, Christina.
Yes. She was, I consider it one of my favorite facts in the world is that she was so much of a better poet than her brother. Not an opinion, fact.
Yeah. Parker and Elliot are there in the tent and they're seeing this last message to Karen. And like they're seeing her reaction, and Elliot tells Parker she did it. She brought Alan back to her. Uh-huh. And then I wrote, and then he leaves so he doesn't get any feelings on him.
Right.
Because he like immediately leaves the tent as Hardison's coming in, and Hardison like kind of like looks over his shoulder at him like, wait, where are you going? And then he's all awkward about how he should greet her, because when she left, she was like, is this going to be like, is this how this is going to be? No. And she just kind of like walks off. So he's like, I guess I'll just chuff her, like give her a little soft punch on the shoulder.
Yeah. And she just goes, bonk.
Yeah. But I love that he like took a step back. Like he's like respecting, like he's not going to try to push her again. Like, because he did that before. He's never tried to push her. He's always like, I'll wait till you come to me. And right. So he saw, okay, hey, I maybe thought we were in a different place than before. You said you were ready for pretzels, but maybe not.
Right.
And then so he pulls it back again. And that's just beautiful. But she, you're right. She grabs him in a big old hug. Yeah. It's so good. And then Sophie and Nate turn to see it. And Sophie like wipes away a little tear, which she's probably already tearing up a little from the video, but then she sees them. But John Rogers said that was actually Gina Bellman reacting to the two of them. And I'm like, ah, that's so good.
Gina Bellman shipped it too.
You know she did. And then we get to go back to Boston. And back at the apartment, Parker is they're cooking dinner together, and I love it so much. And Parker tells Hardison that he shouldn't be expecting this to be normal. And he's okay with that. And then he says, my nana always says, like, what's normal is what works for you. And then he says, and I found this very important to my conspiracy theory mind. He says, we all work okay. Like, not we work okay, the two of us, but like
the OTP3. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. So we all work okay. And then she's like, I should meet your nana. And he's like, yeah, wait, no.
Oh, which brings me back to when Karen, it's Karen, right? The wife.
Yeah.
So when she's listening in on Sophie grifting in the party tent, that line where she says, she's kind of scary.
And Nate's like, oh yeah.
No idea.
But Nate's like, it's so hot. Also, we didn't really dwell on it too long at the beginning, but Sophie's like, you know, you came all the way up to a mountain to avoid talking about what happened between us. And he's like, ha ha, what?
Me? No.
I don't know what you're talking about. But we see Elliot has cooked everything. They've got like steak and mashed potatoes and
Aunt Christian came.
Right? And he compliments Sophie on her original gambit with Drexel. And she starts explaining how she can tell if a guy is the type of guy to forget their conquests. And so she like goes, like ticks off the little mannerisms. They grit their jaw, they stammer, they wave their arms around. It's a dead giveaway. And then Nate shows up and he's like, why is everybody here in my house?
Right.
They're like, well, you know, you told us to lay low and then we didn't and now we're not. So Sophie's like, oh, you know, let me have a word with you. And they both agree to pretend that night never happened.
Yeah, they preface it by being like, they're like, oh God, it was so memorable. And it never happened. No, never happened.
Oh, yeah, we've just gotten to this good place. I don't know. But then she's like, well, you know, now you might as well call me by my real name because you said it enough that night.
Right.
And then he starts to do all of the things that she just said.
The jaw clench, the stammering, the hand waving, the everything. Yes.
Yeah. And that's so sad to me.
Yeah.
That is so sad. And I can't, like, she's a little amused because I think she knew that he didn't remember.
Yeah.
But I think she is also a little bit sad that they've been dancing around this for so long and then finally something happens and he was blackout drunk. Like, that's awful.
Yes. Yes.
You're worth more than this, Sophie.
Yes.
But we have bigger things to worry about because apparently the apartment is bugged.
Yep.
And Hardison finds that bug in like a really obvious place, like right there in that lamp. Was it all the way up in the light?
It was up on the in the inside of the shade, which actually, fair enough, it would be, you know,
it's... I guess if it was up by the light bulb, you wouldn't see it, but I was...
Exactly.
For some reason, I thought it was, like, around the bottom of the shade, and I was like...
No, I thought it was kind of up in there, and, you know, for anybody who is not partisan who's mm-hmm. like constantly looking for such things, it probably would work.
Yeah.
Because looking at light bulbs hurts.
I know. I'm like, now I'm looking at my light bulbs. And he had, you know, they were like, didn't you sweep the place? And he's like, yeah, but this is like the kind of stuff that I use and it's really hard to find. So then they're like, well, you know, it could be any of a bunch of different people we've done. And, you know, Elliot, let's face it, we've done some pretty big jobs. It could be Moreau. It could be Sterling. It could be a bunch of other people. But, you know, all of this puts them at the top of a lot of people's lists. And I love that Parker says, and when you're that high up, because she's our climber. And then Nate gets to say again, it's a long way down.
Yeah.
Oh, a little on the nose again. And then they just start eating dinner.
Of course.
Yes. They're not going to waste this delicious dinner.
No. And by the way, when I say I wish Elliot would cook me dinner, I say this as a woman whose husband is an extraordinary cook and cooks all the time for me. And so I'm utterly spoiled.
Yeah.
That's how honestly the descriptions I've heard of Christian Kane's cooking and how good he is at it and all of that, I'm thoroughly intrigued.
So Christian Kane is also a good cook? It's not just Elliot?
Yes. Apparently that's why they made it part of his character. Because the thing is, I mean, if the one with the, in the first season, the one with the wedding, so it's just the wedding job, when he plays the caterer.
Yeah.
Dude has serious knife skills.
He does.
You don't get those if you do not practice.
This is, I mean, I should have known this. And I,
well, apparently,
my brain just didn't want to accept it because this is very upsetting. Like, it's not okay. He can sing. He can act. He can beat people up.
And he can do stunts. He can, yeah, he's the full, he's really good looking. It's, yeah, it's just not fair.
Fine.
Right?
Fine, Christian Kane, fine.
Fine, just be perfect, Christian Kane, fine. Just go do that.
Yeah. I love at the table, Parker, Nate, and Sophie all have red wine. Elliot has a beer, and Hardison has his orange soda.
Yes.
I wish they'd put it in a goblet, but he just has a bottle. Yeah, and that's it for episode 1 of season 4. It's a great episode.
It is a great episode.
Great
episode. As I said, the tear-jerkingest episode the most tear-jerking episode, I think.
I think so too. Like, other ones have made me tear up, but yeah, like stuff with Nate's son and stuff with Maggie sometimes makes me tear up, but this one consistently.
Yeah.
Does it.
Yeah, I mean, and it really is a testament to, again, go back to full circle, back to the beginning of the podcast, to the skill of Eric Stoltz, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
Because he makes us care about him in literally 2 speeches.
Yeah.
Long speeches, but 2 of them.
Yeah.
You know, basically one delivered at the beginning, which kind of hooks us that, oh, he's really adorable. He loves his wife and, you know, he misses her. And the last one where he's saying goodbye to her at the end of the episode. And oh my God, that's just a freaking tour de force of acting.
Yeah. He's acting to the camera. Like, he's not interacting with someone. Right. Like, he's by himself in both of them. It is fabulous.
Yes.
Yeah. Ugh.
So yeah. So Eric Stoltz, we know you're not listening to this, but you know, tremendous job. Thank you very much for that.
We love and appreciate you.
Yes, we do.
Not
just because you're very, very well preserved.
Well preserved. Do you have a heist light you'd like to talk about?
I don't really. I kind of almost had one last night, and now it kind of went out of my brain because I didn't take any notes because, as we were saying, I'm at an aging stage where if I don't write everything down, I forget it.
It happens. Well, so mine, I sent you the link for this article because it came across somewhere and I was like, oh, this has heist in the title and it's like seasonally appropriate. And then I read it and I was like, this was literally one of the only things I read over the 2 days I was off for Christmas. And I read it to my mom and it is this very in-depth article on crimereads.com It's by Olivia Rutigliano. I'm sorry, Olivia, if I said your name wrong. But it's called How Dr. Seuss Gave Us One of the Most Complex, Socially Important Heist Stories Ever. And it's all about how the Grinch stole Christmas. This article goes places.
Yeah, I kind of started it and I was like, this just seems like a little too much brain chewing for me today. So I'm just going to back away from the article. Although, I mean, it never really occurred to me to think about How the Grinch Stole Christmas as a heist movie, but okay.
I mean, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the whole article, like, I'm going to link it in the description of the episode, but it is a lot. Mm-hmm. It's very good. But she jumps from, like, comparing it to the two other really big popular Christmas stories that came out that year, and how they're about, like, Christmas being stolen in different ways, and, like, linking that to the commercialism that was becoming more rampant in that time period, and like fears of that taking over our souls and things like that, and so many other things. Like, she, like, links him to you know, Ebenezer Scrooge, but then she also is like, actually the character from Dickens that is more like the Grinch is Fagin from Oliver Twist, and then she, like, draws these parallels between Max the dog and Fagin from Oliver Twist, or, like, they both have dogs, so Grinch has Max and
strangled.
Yeah,
I was thinking about, though. Oh, I remember what I was thinking about, and it is, again, it's strangled, and it is absolutely not a heist text at all, unless you're really, again, strangling a bit. I was thinking about how, you know, the concept of stealing a holiday, stealing Christmas specifically. And I immediately, as a child who adored the series, started thinking about The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Mm-hmm.
Because Gladys makes it always winter and never Christmas.
Yes.
And so that was where my brain went with that.
Yeah.
Because I guess Gladys just kind of does an entire heist on Narnia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Taking it over.
That's true. I like this. These are very, very far logical leaps.
Really strained. Yes. Whereas, like,
oh, sorry. She didn't say Fagin. It was Sykes that he resembles more than Fagin. And then she, like, goes into a whole thing about Judaism and, like, the bad stereotypes of Jewish characters in literature. And then she goes into, like, Shylock and Shakespeare. It is a lot.
That's a deep dive.
Very, very interesting. Then she goes into the history of Dr. Seuss writing The Grinch, because he showed up in another story where he was, like, a swindler and he was selling people things that they didn't actually need. And then she, like, yeah, she pulls in Karl Marx. There's so much going on in this article. It is fascinating. And I was like, this was a journey. And my mom's like, what the hell did you just read to me?
I think I'm with your mom.
Me too. And I was like, but I started. I can't stop now. So yeah, so that's, I will, if you are interested in that, I will put the link in the show description.
Yes, yes indeed.
I love supplemental reading. All right, before we wrap up, I started a Patreon page for this podcast to help pay for some of the costs that get incurred when you are using up a lot of memory space on people's websites who are hosting your podcast and things like that. And I do have a subscription to this, to Zoom, that we record on. But yeah, so if anybody wants to donate a couple of dollars a month, there are different levels. I didn't actually need to put this many, but once I started on this theme, so there's hacker, hitter, thief, grifter, and mastermind. So there are five different levels. And then the different levels kind of, like, unlock different things. I've already put up one review. So there'll be, like, book reviews and show reviews. And then there'll be, like, little mini episodes. So I'm hoping that we're going to watch some episodes of the new Korean remake of Leverage. Have you heard about the Korean remake of Leverage?
I think I heard about it a while ago and then I forgot about it. But now I am intrigued.
Yeah, so the first season is up, and so I'm wanting to bring some people on to, like, talk about those episodes, and those will go up as, like, little supplemental, maybe once a month, things on the Patreon. And other stuff, like, people could request things for us to watch and review and stuff like that.
Nice.
So, yeah. So if you want to get out there and do that, the website is patreon.com/ Let's Go Steal a Podcast.
Let's Go Steal a Podcast.
Yes. All right. So, Adele, tell people where they can find you on the internet.
Oh, well, I have a blog that I hardly ever write on, which is adelebuck.com. I am on the Twitters and on the Instagrams at _ Adele Buck, A-D-E-L-E-B-U-C-K. And, you know, I've been trying to get published in romance for the last 2 or 3 years, and I've actually made it again a left turn, and I've written now 2 women's fiction manuscripts. The first one is out on submission right now, and that will be, and if that gets published, it will be published as Adele Buchanan.
Okay. I noticed that kind of changing in some places.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Actually, my pinned tweet is got the blurb for the book that's out on submission right now.
Okay.
At all interested in that. It's a stealth romance. As it's structurally not really something that a lot of people would look at and say, oh, this is a romance. But it really is. And then the book that I have just finished the first draft on and is now out with my agent and my beta readers is, it's essentially got all the beats of a romance novel, except the two protagonists are 2 women in their 30s who suddenly become stepsisters because one of their fathers marries the other one's mother. And so there's the meet cute, the relationship development, the bleak moment, and then the reconciliation at the end, but it is all about sisterhood, and it is called Re-Sisterhood.
I love it. I have 2 sisters, and I just read a book about sisters, and it's a hard topic to write on because sisters are weird as fuck.
Well, I wasn't speaking as someone who is who has a sister. I was speaking as someone who is a sister, and specifically, I became a stepsister when I turned 32.
Oh, wow.
So, yes, I have a stepbrother. Our relationship was far easier than these 2 women's relationship. But yeah, so I did a little bit of strip mining of my own history for, like, what's the weird thing that's happened to me that, oh, yeah, that doesn't happen to everybody.
Gain a sibling in the 30s. I love it. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I'm going to have to read that blurb. I hadn't seen that.
Yeah.
Cool.
So,
yeah. And as always, people can find me on Twitter at Librarian Steve. It's Librarian and the letters STI, which is short, as you know, for Christina. So you won't see us again, but you'll hear us again in 2 weeks when we talk about the second episode of season 2 with Sally Kilpatrick. And I said her name because I forgot what episode was next, even though we looked at it earlier today.
It's the 10 Little Grifters Job.
Yes, the 10 Little Grifters Job.
I might have to, like, horn in on that one and, like, have it be a 3-way podcast.
I would be 100% okay with that. And Sally would as well. Okay, you're coming back.
I love Sally. I love her.
But yeah, thank you so much for being on. I'm so happy you're back.
Pleasure. Are you kidding? My utter pleasure.